Chapter 12 Holy Amotu. Death, in the strict sense, cannot be defined, for whatever predicate we the living attribute to it necessarily belongs to life. This means that death as a category behaves in a manner indistinguishable from the infinite and from God. Agensis, the third analytic of men. One cannot assume the truth of what one declares without presuming the falsity of all incongruous declarations. Since all men assume the truth of their declarations, this presumption becomes at best ironic and at worst outrageous. Given the infinity of possible claims, who could be so vain as to think their dismal claims true? The tragedy, of course, is that we cannot but make declarations. So it seems we must speak as gods to converse as men. Hetatian Exhortations. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Amotu. Inku Haloinus, the non-men had called it, the Ark of the Skies. After his ancient victory over the Enkoroi, Nilgikas had ordered a census of the vessel, the results of which were recorded in the Isufiris, the great annal of the non-men. 3,000 cubits in length, over 2,000 of which were buried with the prow in the mangled depths, 500 in width, 300 in depth. It was a many-chambered mountain, wrought in a gold-gleaming metal that could not be scored, let alone broken. A city rolled into the warped plains of some misbegotten fish, a ruin that the world could not stomach, that the ages could not digest. And as Seswatha and now Keuti discovered, a great gilded crypt. They wandered its abandoned bowels, their steps creaking across the planks of rotted gopher wood that had been used to level the canted walls. Passage after winding passage, chamber after yawning chamber, some as wide as canyons. And everywhere they turned, they found bones, innumerable bones. Most were little more than chalk. They crumbled underfoot, hazing the air about their ankles with dust. The bones of men or non-men, the remains of ancient warriors, perhaps, or captives left to starve in the absolute dark. The fused bones of Bashrag, thick as a prophet's staff and grafted together in threes. The bones of Srank, scattered like those of fish about an abandoned camp. And others they found impossible to identify, bones with singular shapes, some as small as earrings, others as long as a skiff's mast. They gleamed like oiled bronze and could not be broken, despite the legendary strength of now Keuti's arms. Never had Seswatha suffered such a horror, diffuse enough to ignore moment by moment, but possessing a tidal profundity, as though all that he cherished lay exposed, not just to harm, but to some horrifically contrary truth. Intellectually, he understood the why and the wherefore, even as his viscera quailed. They walked the pits of Min Oroikus, a place where the Enkoroi, in their wickedness, had gnawed at boundaries between the world and the outside for thousands of years. And now the howl of their damnation lay near, very near. This was a topos, a place where hard lines of reality had become shading. They could hear it in the cavernous echoes, gibbering screams in the scrape of their steps, groaning multitudes in the rattle of their coughs, inhuman roaring in the ring of their voices. And they could see it, as though images had been stitched to their periphery, many jawed faces snapping out of the black, weeping children. Akamian lost count of the times he saw now Keuti abruptly whirl, trying to catch apparitions in the certainty of direct sight. Where the going was not treacherous, Akamian staggered in now Keuti's wake, staring thoughtlessly at what little the light of his hooded lantern revealed. The husk of detritus, hanging in place like discarded skin. The walls of gold, their uterine curves, skewed to the pitch of the Ark's final descent. The miniature panels of script stamped, it seemed, across every interior surface. Even their reflections, stretched grotesque across the surrounding walls and haloed with an unnatural nimbus of black. Exhausted to the point of shambling steps and shaking hands, they finally paused, hoping to steal some furtive sleep. A commune sat huddled in the crotch between bulkheads, at once drowsing and wringing his tight-clutched limbs in horror. He found himself revisiting every footstep, every gaping blackness, every moldering passage, wondering where his hope had at last guttered out. How could they ever escape such a place? Even if they found what he searched for. He could feel them, piling labyrinthine into the distances above and below him, the consuming hollows. It seemed hell itself roared inaudible about them. This place.
Bones!
Now Kayuti spat between chattering teeth.
They had to be bones!
Akamian cringed at the sound of his voice, looked to his forlorn shadow. The prince hugged himself the same as he, as though shielding nakedness from blowing ice.
There are some, Akamian whispered, who argue that the entire Ark is a thing of bone, that vein and skin once pulsed across these walls. You mean the Ark once lived?
Akamian nodded, even as he swallowed for dread.
The Enkoroi called themselves Children of the Ark. The most ancient non-men lays refer to them as the Orphans. So this thing, this place, mothered them?
Seswatha smiled.
Or fathered. The fact is, we haven't the words for such things. Even if we could pierce the Shroud of Millennia, I fear this place would remain beyond our understanding.
But I understand full well, the young prince said. You're saying that Golgotharoth is a dead womb.
Akamian stared at him, warred with a shame that threatened to break his gaze like lead upon glass.
I suppose I am.
Now Kayuti peered through the surrounding gloom.
Obscenity, he muttered. Obscenity? Why, Seswatha? Why would they bring war against us?
To close the world,
seemed all he could muster.
To seal it shut.
The young man leapt forward, seized him about the shoulders.
She lives,
he hissed, his eyes bright with despair and suspicion.
You told me, you promised.
She lives, Akamian lied. He even held the young man's cheek and smiled.
I've doomed us.
Come,
the High King's son said, standing tall in the dark.
I fear the dreams sleep might bring.
Expressionless, he resumed picking his way through the black. After a breath that seemed more ice than air, Seswatha stumbled after him. Now Kayuti, heir to Trisi, the greatest light of the dynasty that called itself Anasarimber, the greatest light of men. Kellis reached. Out from the warmth of skin pressed in fabric, from the memory of arcane song,
I have walked, father, crossed the very world.
Ignoring the lacquered furniture, he sat cross-legged on the veranda floor, feeling the exhalation of stuffy rooms war with the cold air descending from the void of night. With sightless eyes he stared across the garden, which was both shadowy and haphazard, terraced and overgrown. The flower beds thronged with devil's claw and nettle. The cherry trees stood in thickets, the last of their delinquent blossoms hanging brown in the cool dew. There was the scent of caustic in the gutters where the slaves had poured wine that had gone to vinegar. There was the sharp musk of feral cats.
He reached.
Through masonry and burnt brick, over haggard slopes across the Sherazor plains.
I have followed the shortest path.
He saw not ceilings, but distributions of hanging weights. He saw not walls, but fears, a pageant of real and imagined enemies. He saw not a villa, but a long-dead imperial favor, the relic of a moribund race. Everywhere he turned, he apprehended the pillars among the pilasters, the ground beneath the scuffed floors. Everywhere he looked, he saw what came before.
Soon, father. Soon, I will darken your door.
Without warning, the drafts became humid with the scent of jasmine and feminine lust. He heard bare feet, her bare feet, pad over marble. The bruise of sorcery was plain, almost rank, but he didn't turn to acknowledge her. He remained perfectly still, even when her shadow fell across his back.
Tell me,
she said in ancient Kunayurik, both fluid and precise. What are the Dunyane? Kellis bent his thought backward, yoked the legion that was his soul. Likelihood chased likelihood, some to fruition, others to extinction. Esmonette, entwined in boiling light. Esmonette bleeding, broken at his feet. Words, winding and forking, calling out apocalypse and salvation. Of all his encounters since leaving Ishual, none demanded more exactitude. The consult had come. We are men, he replied. Like other men. After looming over him for an instant, she turned and sashayed, quite naked, across the portico.
I, she said as she reclined upon a black bamboo settee, do not believe you.
In his periphery, he saw her palm her breasts, press fingers down the slope of her belly. Her hands clawed her inner thighs. She drew up a knee, then with hooked fingers plumbed the depths of her sex. She cooed in pleasure, as though tasting a rumored delicacy for the first time. Then smiling, she withdrew two glistening fingers, raised them to the hollow of her mouth. She swallowed them.
Your seed, she murmured, is bitter. It means to provoke me.
He turned to her, drew her into the cauldron of his attention. Fluttering pulse, shallow breath, beads of sweat breaking into threads. He could smell her skin tingle in the night air, the residue of salt. He could even see the swelling of her breasts, the heat of her womb. But her thoughts. It was as though the strings between her face and soul had been severed and refastened to something both sleek and alien, something not human. Kellis smiled as a father might when trying to teach a gentle lesson to an imperious child.
You cannot kill me, he said. I'm beyond you.
She smirked.
How could you say this? You know nothing of me or my kind.
Though the roots of her tone and expression escaped him, the incipient sneer was unmistakable. It despised condescension. It was proud. She laughed.
Did you think Akamian's stories could prepare you? What the Mandate dream is but a sliver of what I've lived, of what I've seen. I've walked in the no-god shadow. I've looked across the void and blotted your world by holding a fingertip before it. No, you know nothing of me or my kind.
Pupils dilated, nipples erect, an imperceptible flush about her neck and chest, fingers curling the downy hair of her sex. Kellis thought of the Srank in their rutting frenzy for blood, of Sarcellus hardening to the promise of violence that night about the Galioth fire.
So similar.
They were the template of their creations, he realized. They had implanted their own carnal longings, made their own appetite the instrument of their domination.
So what are you then? Kellis asked. What are the Inkoroi?
We, she cooed, are a race of lovers.
The expected answer. Recollection cycled through his soul, not explicit and singular, but implicit and innumerable. Everything Akamian had said regarding these abominations. He slackened his face in the simulacrum of profound sorrow.
And for this, you are damned.
Flaring nostrils, a faint quickening of the pulse.
We were born for damnation's sake, she said with deceptive calm. Our very nature is our transgression. Look at this exquisite body, the heights of her bosom, the temple of her sex. I climb and I enter because I must.
She fingered her pubis as she spoke, clutched tight her left breast.
And for this, she gasped. For this I am to heave and scream in lakes of fire because of boundaries of skin?
Kellis knew not the length or beam of its inhuman intelligence, but he knew it counted grievances. All souls, almost out of necessity, armed themselves with arguments and accusations of misunderstanding. A circle, after all, could have only one center.
Denial is the way, Kellis said. Boundaries are written into the order of things.
She matched his gaze in a way Esmonette never could, stared as though he were something pathetic and execrable.
It sees what I'm trying to do. But you, she said with breathless sarcasm, you could rewrite the scripture of my doom. Hmm, prophet? She barked with laughter. There is no absolution for your kind. She had raised her hips to the liquid flutter of her fingers. Oh, but there is. So you would destroy the world? She shuddered, her body afire with arousal. She lowered her buttocks, crossed her legs about her fingers. To save my soul, hmm? So long as there are men, there are crimes. So long as there are crimes, I am damned. Tell me, Dunyain, what track would you follow? What would you do to save your soul? Track, it had said. The Skilvendi. I should have killed him. She grinned at his silence. You already know, don't you? I can feel the memory of you, the sweet ache of having hung from your bronze hook. Rutting is merely the way of things. Hunger, appetite. Men gild, men clothe, men dance their blind pantomimes. But it all comes to love in the end. She abruptly stood and strolled toward him. Her hands wandered over the patterns the settee had pressed into her skin. Love is the way. And yet these little demons you call gods decree otherwise? Dole out their rewards in proportion to our suffering? No. She paused before him, her slight form magnificent in the play of gloom and light. I would save my soul. She reached out to trace his lips with a shining fingertip. Esmanette, burning for Congress. For all his breeding, all his conditioning, Kellis could feel the ancient instinct rise. What kind of game? He caught her wrist. She doesn't love you, she said, tugging her wrist free. Not truly. The words jarred. But why? What was this darkness? Pain? She worships, Kellis found himself replying, and has yet to understand the difference. How many secrets could it see? How much did it know? Such a marvel, she said, what you've accomplished. So much stolen. It spoke as though knowing much warranted knowing all. It tries to lure me, draw me into open discourse. My father has been here 30 years. Long enough to require a holy war to overcome him? Long enough. She smiled, drew two fingers across her sweaty breastbone. Though her body remained young, her eyes possessed an age not her own. Again, she simpered, I don't believe you. You are your father's heir, not his assassin. And the air reeked of sorcery. Her hands found him through his robe, began fondling. Kellis stood bewildered. He wanted to seize her, thrust deep into her burning center. He would show her, show her! His robe had been hiked, and by his own hand. The cool of her palms whisked across and against his flame. Tell me, she moaned again and again, and though Kellis knew these to be her words, he found himself hearing, take me. He lifted her with ease, spread her across the settee. He would pin her to the deep. He would plunge and hammer until she howled for release. Who is your father? A voice whispered. Still her hands milked him. Never had he suffered anything so sweet. Clutching her legs by the crotch of her knees, he pressed them out and back, bared her moist beauty. The world roared. Tell me. With deft fingers, she drew him across her slick fire. What was happening? How could lightning be sparked in the brush of greased skin? How could moans exhaled through the lips of a woman sound so beautiful? Who is Moengus? The voice persisted. What is his intent? Kellis pressed through the fiery veil into her arching cry. To make manifest, he heard himself gasp, the thousandfold thought. For a heartbeat, the world stopped. He saw it, old and hoary and rotted, staring out from his wife's eyes, the Inkoroi. Sorcery! The ward was simple, one of the first Akamian had taught him.
an ancient Kunayoric Dara, proof against what were called incipient sorceries. His words racked the sultry air. For a moment, the light of his eyes shone across her skin. The darkness faltered and the shadow fell from his soul. He staggered back two steps, his phallus wet and chill and hard. She laughed as he covered himself, her voice guttural with inhuman intonations.
Bait it. Across the world in Golgotharoth, Kellis gasped, still stamping out the coals of his manic lust.
The Mangekka squat about your true flesh, rocking to the mutter of endless cants. The Synthes is but a node. You are no more than the reflection of a shadow, an image cast upon the water of Esmanet. You possess subtlety, yes, but you haven't the depth to confront me.
Akamian had told him of this creature, that its capacities would be largely restricted to glamours, compulsions, and possessions. The great shout that was its true form, the schoolman had said, could be heard only as whispers and insinuations at such a distance.
I must own this encounter.
Come, she said, springing to her feet, stalking him as he retreated across the veranda.
Kill me, then. Strike me down.
A mask of counterfeit horror. Once again, Kellis unlaced the bindings of selfhood, rolled open the inner surfaces of his soul. Once again, he reached. The past possessed weight. Where the young were like flotsam, forever drawn spinning into the current of passing events, the old were like stone. The proverbs and parables spoke of sobriety, restraint, but more than anything, it was boredom that rendered the aged immune to the press of events. Repetition, not enlightenment, was the secret of their detachment. How did one move a soul that had witnessed all the world's permutations?
But you can't, she cackled. Can you? Look upon this pretty shell, these lips, these eyes, this cunny. I am what you love.
What was more, the Skilvendi had schooled it. The non sequiturs, the sudden questions, the thing had made whim the principle of its action, just as Nayur had. Kellis reached.
After all, she said, what man would strike down his wife?
He drew his sword and Shoya pressed its point against the white tile floor between them.
Adunyane, he replied.
She stopped above the blade, close enough to pinch the tip between the toes of her right foot. She glared with ancient fury.
I am Orang, tyranny, a son of the void you call heaven. I am Inkoroi, a raper of thousands. I am he who would tear this world down. Strike, Anasarimber!
Kellis reached and saw himself through the obscenity's eyes, the enigma who would draw out his father, Moengus. Kellis reached, though with fingers lacking tips, palms without heat. He reached and he grasped. A soul that had snaked across all the world's ages, taking lover after lover, exulting in degradation, spilling seed across innumerable dead. The Nanmen of Ishoriel, the Norserai of Trice and Soglish, warring, endlessly warring to forestall damnation. A race with 100 names for the vagaries of ejaculation, who had silenced all compassion, all pity, to better savor the reckless chorus of their lusts, stalking, endlessly stalking the world they would make their shrieking harem. A life so old that only he, Anasarimber Kellis, was unprecedented.
Only the Dunyane were new. Who were these men, these Anasarimber, who hailed from Golgotharoth's very shadow, who could see through masks of skin, who could subvert ancient faiths, who could enslave holy wars with nothing more than words and glances? Who bore the name of their ancient foe? And Kellis realized there was only one question here. Who were the Dunyane?
They fear us, father.
Strike!
Esmanet cried, her arms back, her shining breasts pressed forward. And he did strike, though with the flat of his palm. Esmanet sailed backward, rolled nude across the tiles.
The No-God,
he said, advancing. He speaks to me in my dreams.
I, Esmanette replied, spitting blood as she pressed herself from the floor. Don't believe you.
Kella seized the black maul of her hair, heaved her to her feet. He hissed into her ear.
He says that you failed him on the plains of Mengeta. Lies! Lies!
He comes, warlord, for this world, for you.
Strike me again, she whispered. Please.
He threw her back on the floor. She writhed at his feet, thrusting her sex like an accusatory finger.
Fuck me, she whispered. Fuck me.
But the lustful glamour fell from him, deflected by the Dara ward. He stood unmoved.
Your secrets have been uncovered, he said in high oratorical tones. Your agents are scattered, your designs overthrown. You've been defeated, warlord.
And for the first time, she replied according to his anticipations.
Ah, but there are as many battlefields as there are moments, Dunyane.
Pause. The cycling of possibilities.
You're a distraction, Kella said.
Esmanette herself had said it. They would do anything to deny him the Gnosis. Her eyes flared white, and for an instant she looked like a leering Nilnameshi demon. A strange and preternatural laughter filtered through the overgrown garden, twined like snakes across the open spaces.
Akamian, Kellis whispered, is already dead. The thing sneered.
It rolled her head like a doll, then slumped across the cold stone. The sound of clinking stone, scarcely audible over the urgent counterpoint of voices in the garden beyond the iron-fretted windows. A single plate of marble ran across the threshold of what once, back when the Nansur had ruled Amotu, had been an ancestor shrine. As though of its own volition, it tipped upright, then slipped aside, revealing a black slot scarcely large enough to fit a Tidoni shield. A foot swung out, its toes popping as they stretched. Rising like a stalk, the knee and thigh followed. Another foot appeared, then a hand, until all three limbs were bent and braced about the aperture like some deformed spider. Then slowly, deliberately, the figure of a woman emerged, as though drawn from the pages of a book. Fanashila. She danced across the pallid floors, encountered a bleary-eyed Opsara shuffling back to the nursery from the latrine. She broke her neck, then paused, breathing, willing her erection to subside. At some point, crossing shadows, she became Esmanette. It pressed her cheek against the bronze-strapped mahogany of his chamber door, heard nothing save the deep breathing of its quarry. The air fairly sang with residual odors, garlic from the kitchens, rotted teeth, armpits and anuses, soot, myrrh, and sandalwood. It retrieved the koray from a pocket in her linen shift, then with deft movements tied it against her throat with leather string. It pressed open the door, leaning hard on the handle to silence the unoiled hinges. It had hoped to find him asleep, but of course his wards had awakened him. It stood at the dark entrance, her false face swollen with tears. Moonlight cast an oblong of pale squares across the floor at her feet. He was sitting in his bed, alarmed and ashen-faced. Though he peered, it could see him quite clearly. The astonished eyes, the thoughtful brow, the five white streaks of his beard. He reeked of terror.
Esme, he hissed. Esme, is that you?
Hunching its shoulders, it pulled her arms from the linen shift so that it fell to the cord tied about her waist. She heard his breath catch at the sight of her breasts.
Esme, what are you doing?
I need you, Akka.
The koray about your throat. I thought they were forbidden.
Kellis asked that I wear it.
Please, remove it.
Raising her arms to the back of her neck, she untied it, let it clatter to the floor. She stepped into the pale, fretted light so that it mapped the contours of her stolen body. It knew she was a thing of beauty.
Akka, it whispered. Love me, Akka.
No,
This is wrong. He'll know, Esme, he'll know.
He already knows, it said, crawling onto the foot of his bed.
She could smell his hammering heart, the promise of hot blood. There was such fear in him.
Please,
she gasped, drawing her breasts over the outline of his knees and thighs, his face so near, hanging in darkness. The blow struck true, through the silken sheets, through her sternum, her heart and spine. Even still, it managed to heave forward across the blade to strike his windpipe, and as the blackness swirled down, it saw him through the deceiving glamour, Captain Haorsa, thrashing in his very own death throes. The Dunyane had outwitted them.
Traps within traps,
the thing called Esmanette carelessly thought.
So beautiful,
in what passed for its dying soul.
A Kamian.
The lantern fell to the rotted floor, light rolled across heaped bones, and Seswatha felt himself lifted and thrown back into the blackness. Something hard cracked against the base of his skull. The world darkened until all he could see was his student's raving face.
Where is she?
Now Kayuti cried.
Where?
And all he could think of was his voice pealing through the inhuman spaces, reaching, filtering, sealing their doom. They walked the halls of Golgotharoth. Golgotharoth!
Akamian! It's Zin!
You lied!
No!
Akamian cried, shielding his eyes against the light hanging above him.
Listen! Listen!
But it was Proyas before him, his face drawn, grave with the utter absence of expression.
I'm sorry, old tutor, the prince said, but it's Zin. He's calling for you.
Without any real comprehension, he cast his blankets aside and bolted from his cot. For an instant, he teetered. Unlike the Inku Haloinus, the canvas walls of the prince's pavilion were square with the ground. Proyas steadied him, and they shared a long and somber look. For so long, the Marshal of Atrempus had stood at their borderlands, guarding the frontiers across which the doubt of the one had warred with the certainty of the other. It seemed terrifying to stand face to face without him. But it also seemed true, a kind of human proof. They had always stood this near, Akamian realized. They had merely stared off in different directions. Without warning, he found himself clasping the younger man's hand. It was not warm, but it seemed so very alive.
I did not mean to disappoint you,
Proyas murmured. Akamian swallowed. Only when things were broken did their meaning become clear. Kellis held her, shaking in their bed.
I do love you,
Esmanette cried.
I do!
Shouts still echoed through the corridors. The 100 pillars, Kellis knew, fanned across the grounds, searching for the Inkoroi Synthes, but they would find nothing. Save for Captain Haorsa's death, everything had transpired as he'd expected. Orang had sought only to deny him the Gnosis, not his life. So long as they knew nothing of the Dunyane, the consult were trapped in the pincers of a paradox. The more they needed to kill him, the more they needed to learn him and to find his father. Which was why Akamian had been their target, not Kellis. Kellis hadn't known whether Esmanette would recall her possession, but the instant her eyes fluttered open, he'd realized that she not only remembered, she remembered as though she herself had spoken what was spoken, said what was said. There had been many hard words.
I do love you,
she wept.
Yes,
he replied, his voice far deeper, far wider than she could possibly hear. Quivering lips, eyes parsed between horror and remorse, panting breath.
But you said!
Only, he lied, what needed to be heard, Esme, nothing more.
You have to believe me.
I do, Esme. I do believe.
She clutched her cheeks, scratched welts across them.
Always the whore. Why must I always be the whore?
He looked through her, past her bewildered hurt, down to the beatings and the abuse, to the betrayals and beyond, out to a world of rank lust, shaped by the hammers of custom, girded with scripture, scaled by ancient legacies of sentiment and belief.
Her womb had cursed her, even as it made her what she was. Immortality and bliss, this was the living promise all women bore between their thighs. Strong sons and gasping climax. If what men called truth were ever the hostage of their desires, how could they fail to make slaves of their women, to hide them like hoarded gold, to feast on them like melons, to discard them like rinds? Was this not why he used her, the promise of sons in her hips? Dunyane sons. Her eyes were like silver spoons in the gloom, shimmering with scarcely held waters. He looked through them and saw so much he could never undo.
"Hold me," she whispered. "Hold me, please."
Like so many others, she bore his toll, and it was only beginning. Akamian had always thought it strange that so little was felt at the appropriate moment. Only afterward, and even then it never seemed proper. When the pederisk, the title given to mandate schoolmen devoted to finding the few among Enron's children, had come to their hovel bent on taking Akamian, a boy with great promise, to Etyrsus, Akamian's father had denied him. Not for love of his son, Akamian would later decide, but for reasons both more pragmatic and more principled. Akamian had proven himself a quick study at sea, one who need not be hit as often as the others. And more importantly, Akamian was his son, and none other might have him. The pederisk, a willowy man with a face as hard and weathered as any mariner's, was neither surprised nor impressed by his father's drunken defiance. Akamian would never forget the way his smell, rosewater and jasmine, had owned the sour room. His father became violent, and with a dreadful air of routine, the schoolman's men-at-arms began beating him. Akamian's mother had shrieked, his brothers and sisters had squalled, but a strange coldness had settled upon Akamian, the monolithic selfishness of which only children and madmen are sometimes capable. He had gloated. Before that day, Akamian would never have believed his father could be so easily broken. For children, hard-hearted fathers were elemental, more deity than human. As judges, they seemed to stand beyond all possible judgment. Witnessing the humiliation of his father produced the first truly sorrowful day of his life, as well as a day of triumph. To see the great breaker broken, how couldn't this transform the proportions of a young boy's world?
"Damnation!" his father had screeched. "Hell has come for you, boy! Hell!"
Only afterward, as they trundled up the coast in the schoolman's cart, would he cry, overwhelmed by loss and delinquent regret. Far, far too late.
"I see it, Akka."
A voice barely more than a rasp. Zynemus.
"Where I'm going. I see it now."
"And what do you see?" Humor them. This was what one did with the grievously ill.
"Nothing. Shush.
I'll describe it all to you. The many-eyed walls, the first temple, the sacred heights. I'll be your eyes in. You'll see Shima through me."
Through the eyes of a sorcerer.
Proyas's slaves had used screens to mark off an ad hoc sick room for the Marshal of Atrempus. Embroidered pheasants cavorted across them, their tail feathers twining into the very trees they perched upon. Only two lanterns provided illumination, both of them hooded in blue cloth at the insistence of the physician priests. Apparently, Akiagni was more discriminating with his colors than with his victims. The result was peculiar, even eerie, something between firelight and moonlight. Everything in the spare chamber, the sagging canvas ceilings, the rush-matted ground, the blankets hanging from the marshal's cot, possessed the nauseous pall of sickness. Akamian knelt at the side of the cot, gently wiping his friend's brow with a wetted cloth. He dabbed the water pooled in his sockets, more because of the unnerving way it glinted in the gloom, like liquid eyes, than for the comfort of his friend. Yet again, he found himself at war with the urge to flee. Of all the unclean spirits, few were as terrifying or bloodthirsty as those belonging to dread disease.
Pulma had possessed him, the physician priests had said, one of the most fearsome of Akiagni's innumerable demons, the lung plague. The marshal jerked and convulsed. He arched across his cot as though his body were a bow taken up and drawn by something unseen. He made noises that could only be described as unmanly. Akamian clutched his bearded cheek, whispered words he could not recall afterward. Then, just as abruptly, Zynemus went slack. Once again his limbs were lost between the folds of his blankets. Akamian wiped the sweat from the quivering planes of his face. Shush, he whispered between the man's clawing breaths. Shush.
How the rules, the marshal coughed, have changed.
What do you mean?
The game between us, Benjuka.
Akamian still had no clue as to his meaning, but he could think of nothing to say. It seemed a sin somehow to question him twice.
Remember how it was?
Zynemus asked.
The way you would wait in the dark while I took counsel with the great?
Yes, I remember.
Now it's I who wait.
Again, Akamian couldn't think of anything to say. It was as though words had come to their end, to the point where only impotence and travesty could follow. Even his thoughts prickled.
Did you?
The marshal abruptly asked. Did I what?
Did you ever win?
Benjuka? Akamian blinked, stretched his face into an aching smile. Not against you, Zin. But someday.
I think not.
And why's that? He hesitated, fearful of what answer this question might elicit.
Because you try too hard,
Zynemus said.
And when the plate doesn't yield.
He coughed, convulsed about pustulate lungs. Akamian repeated, when the plate doesn't yield. He humored him no longer. Selfish fool.
I see nothing,
the marshal gasped.
Sweet Sejanus, I see no—
He cried out as though drowning in clotted blood, gagged and thrashed. The sick, sweet flush of bowel filled the room. Then he went slack. For several heartbeats, all Akamian could do was stare. Without his eyes, Zynemus seemed so sealed in.
Sin!
His friend's mouth worked soundlessly. Madly, Akamian thought of the fish heads heaped beneath his father's gutting table, mouths without stomachs opening and closing, as slow as milkweed waving in the breeze.
Leave me,
his friend gasped.
Leave me be.
This is no time for pride, you fool!
No,
the marshal of Atrempus whispered.
This is the only—
And then it happened. One moment, his complexion was mottled by the pallid exertions only the dying can know, and then, as quickly as cloth soaking water, it went purple-gray. A cooler air settled through the canvas spaces, the quiet of utterly inert things. Lice thronged from Zynemus's scalp onto his brow, across his waxy face. Akamian brushed at them, twitched them away with the numb fastidiousness of those who deny death by acting otherwise. He clutched his friend's hand, began kissing his fingers. In the morning, Proyas and I will take you to the river, he said breathlessly. Bathe you. Whining silence. It seemed that his heart slowed, hesitated, like a boy unsure of the sincerity of his father's permission. His lips tightened, and a great void slowly opened in his chest, at first tugging and then lunging, demanding that he breathe. With a shameful reluctance, he watched him in the darkness, Crygeti Zynemus, this man who would be his older brother, this corpse with the face of an only friend. The first of the lice found him. Akamian could feel them, like the tickle of insight. He breathed, drew the rank air deep, and though his cry reached out across the plains, it fell far short of Shima. He pondered the plate, rubbing his hands together for warmth. Zynemus taunted him with a nasty chuckle.
Always so dour when you play Benjuka.
It's a wretched game.
You say that only because you try too hard.
No, I say that because I lose. With an air of chagrin, he moved the only stone among his silver pieces, a replacement for a piece stolen, or so Zynemus claimed, by one of his slaves. Another aggravation. Though pieces were nothing more than how they were used, the stone impoverished his play somehow, broke the miserly spell of a complete set. Why do I get the stone? Achaemenid did not sleep that night. One of the 100 pillars had come, summoning both him and Proyas to the villa in the encampment's heart. Apparently, there had been some kind of attempt on Kellis's life. Achaemenid refused outright. When Proyas made ready to leave, Achaemenid reproached him with words so harsh, so blasphemous, that the waiting guardsman drew his sword aghast. Achaemenid fled before the prince could retort. For a time he wandered the dark ways of the holy war, thinking of the way the dew made his sandaled feet ache, of how the nail of heaven never moved, of the way the men of the Tusk all slumbered beneath tents of Kianine manufacture, their differences, their heritages, shed like rubbish on the long path to redemption. He thought of everything, anything, save that which might drive the wedges of madness deeper. Then, as dawn brightened over the promise of Shima in the east, he made his way back to the fortified villa. He climbed the slopes and passed unchallenged through the gates, and finally found himself walking the overgrown garden, heedless of the burrs and claws that snarled his robes, of the nettles that inflamed his skin. He waited below the veranda that fronted the main apartments, where his wife moaned about the cock of the man he worshipped. He waited for the warrior prophet. A lark called out from the dried stump of a cedar. Fiddlenecks, their orange blooms bent along hairy stems, trembled in the breeze. He drowsed, dreamed of Golgotharoth.
Akka?
A blessed voice said as though from nowhere. You look horrible. Achaemenid found himself instantly awake, thinking, where is she? I need her.
She sleeps, Kellis said. She suffered grievously last night, much as you did.
The warrior prophet stood above him, his flaxen hair and white gown glaring in the morning sunlight. Achaemenid blinked at his figure. Despite the beard, the resemblance to now Keyuti, his ancient cousin, was unmistakable. For some reason, Achaemenid felt his fury and resolve crumble, as a child's might before a mother or a father. A grimace stole across his face.
Why?
He croaked. At first, he feared the man would misunderstand him, think that he asked after Esmanet and his monstrous decision to use her as a tool to sound the consult.
Our end does not give meaning to our life, Akka. The manner of Zin's de-
No!
He cried, leaping to his feet.
Why didn't you heal him?
For the briefest instant, Kellis seemed taken aback. But then all was as it should be. Comfort glittered in his eyes. Understanding shouted from the line of his smile, sad and faint. Achaemenid's ears roared with such violence that he heard nothing of Kellis's reply, save that it was false. He literally stumbled, such was the force of the revelation. Strong hands drew him upright. Kellis, grasping him by the shoulders, staring intently into his face. But the intimacy, that eroticism of awe that had braced all their exchanges, had vanished. A vacancy, cold and heartless, shouted from the beloved face.
How?
And somehow, unaccountably, Achaemenid knew that he was truly awake. Perhaps for the very first time. No longer was he that hapless child in this man's gaze. Achaemenid pulled away, not horrified, just blank. What are you? Kellis's gaze did not falter.
You flinch from me, Akka. Why?
You are not a prophet. What are you?
The transformation of his expression was subtle enough that someone standing three or more paces away would have missed it, but for Achaemenid, it was enough to send him stumbling back in horror. As one, Kellis's every facial nuance went dead, utterly dead.
Then, in a voice as cold as winter slate, I am the truth.
Truth?
Akamian struggled to regain his composure, but the horror spilled through him, unlooping like entrails. He fought for his breath, to see past the glaring sky, to hear through the buzzing world.
True!
An iron grip around his throat. His head yanked back, his face thrust to the sun, like a doll hoisted to the sky. He hadn't even seen Kellis move.
Look, the dead voice said. No strain. Nothing of this physical cruelty in his voice.
Nothing. The sun speared Akamian's eyes, seemed blinding, even with them clenched shut.
Look.
Without added emphasis, except for the finger which caressed his trachea in such a way that bile began to burn the back of his throat.
Can't see.
Abruptly, he dropped face forward against the ground. Before he'd regained his knees, he'd begun his arcane muttering. He knew his capabilities. He knew he could destroy him still. But the voice would not relent.
Does this mean the sun is empty?
Akamian paused, turned his face from the grass and scree, squinted at the figure looming above.
Do you think?
A voice crackled across every possibility of hearing.
The god would be anything other than remote?
Akamian lowered his forehead to the biting weeds. Everything spinning, slumping.
Or do I lie in that, since I am all souls, I choose the one that will turn the most hearts?
And tears answered,
Don't hit me. Please, Papa, please don't.
Or should it speak of treachery, that my purposes move beyond yours, encompass yours? He raised shaking hands to his ears.
I'll be good, I swear.
He fell to his side. Sobbed against hard, bristling earth. The road, so long, so painful. The hunger. Inrau, Zynemus, dead. Dead. Because of me, oh dear God. The warrior prophet sat next to him as he wept, gently holding one of his hands, his face impassive, eyes closed and turned to the sun.
Tomorrow, he said, we march on Shimei.